Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to another Hindu Studies channel podcast of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. You can find out about my background at rajbalkaran.com/academia. More importantly, I'm speaking with Anway Mukhopadhyay, who is currently in West Bengal at the University of Burdwan on his very interesting book, The Goddess in Hindu and Tantric Traditions, Devi as Corpse. Anway, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you so much, Raj, for inviting me here. And it would be great to share my thoughts with you and also with the people who listen to this.
So tell us the origins of this book. How did you start this project?
Now, it has a very interesting origin. The idea originated with me while I was in Varanasi. Actually, I was teaching at Varanasi University at that point of time in 2016. So suddenly this idea occurred to me, and I suddenly thought that I could do something about the Devi as Corpse, which was a very striking kind of idea to me. Right? I mean, it was a kind of paradox, a living paradox. So while the goddess is always seen as metonymic of life, as related to Ella Vital, as related to the earth, etc. In the Hindu tantric traditions, we have this figuration, this very peculiar figuration of the goddess as not just death in the metaphysical sense, in the conceptual abstract sense, but also in the sense of a concrete corpse, particularly in the case of the myth of Shiva and Sati, as it has been ramified in the tantric traditions of Eastern India in particular. For instance, if you think about the mainstream texts of, the mainstream Puranic texts which talk about Shiva and Sati, that myth, this Satipitha myth is not actually there. Like, you know, the creation of the Satipithas where Sati's limbs fall and then the Satipithas emerge, this kind of story is not there. But when we think about the medieval tantric texts coming from the eastern parts of India, we come upon this particular narrative of the creation of the Satipithas, and it becomes a kind of central narrative unit as far as the tantrically inflected Puranas coming from the eastern parts of India are concerned. For instance, if you think about the Mahabhagavata Upa Purana, the Kalika Purana, or the Brihadharma Purana, and in fact, much of the ritualistic and sort of devotional approach to the goddess, particularly in Bengal, in Assam, in Orissa, also to some extent. As far as that is concerned, there is a huge influence of these texts on the Devi worshipping sort of general public, and also on the sadhakas, I mean the spiritual aspirants, so who are working within the frame of tantric Shaktism. At that point of time, in Varanasi, I couldn't finish this project. In fact, I couldn't embark on this project at all because I was writing another book at that point of time. That was also on goddess spirituality, but that was a very different kind of book. But while I was working at Bardhaman, I mean, immediately after coming back from Varanasi to Bardhaman, this place in West Bengal, which also happens to be one of the sort of central places where this tantric Shaktism developed and this sort of Satipita oriented myth developed, after coming back to West Bengal, I began to think about this idea in a kind of new way. And in fact, while I was in Varanasi, I was thinking a lot about this sort of coterminousness of life and death, how they become coextensive in the ritualistic sort of domain of Varanasi. For instance, Varanasi is called a Mahashmashana, so it's a great crematorium, but that becomes enlivened by the presence of the Devi along with Shiva, and then it becomes the Anandakanana of Shiva. However, when I started working on this sati myth, I was struck by certain central paradoxes, you know. For instance, this very interesting idea that that the Devi, who is the eternal, absolute, metaphysical entity, because as far as the Eastern Tantric Shaktism is concerned, in the Tantric Shaktism of Eastern India, is concerned, the Devi is not just the Shakti of the Absolute. Rather, Devi is the Absolute as well as the Shakti thereof. Now, within this kind of theological framework, how do you account for the idea of Devi as corpse? I mean, the corpse would apparently indicate pure materiality. You know, there is no scope for spirituality there. As it were, you know, it's totally beyond the domain of spirituality. As it were, it belongs to the domain of materiality and pure corporeality, which is absolutely delinked from the spirit. But at the same time, we have to recall that this Devi, I mean, who is apparently dying, and I would like to put the term dying within quotes, because it's a central paradox as far as Tantric Shaktism is concerned, because the Devi is immortal, right? I mean, she is eternal, and at the same time, her corpse becomes the sort of center of a very new kind of goddess spirituality, where her corpse and the parts thereof are absolutely important for the spiritual sadhana. So there, as it were, the bodily aspect of Devi's corpse is as important as the spiritual aspect of Devi in her transcendent form. So this paradox was exactly what I start off from. And in fact, while working on this project, I was continuously responding to a lot of central paradoxes within this theological framework. Because here, theological, or if you wish, a kind of theological framework. Now, the interesting point is that when we think about Devi as corpse, the first problem is that here we have an apparently incommensurable kind of, difference between Devi as pure transcendence and Devi as corpse. But somehow the Tantric Shaktism of Eastern India seeks to wed these two apparently sort of discordant ideas together, and it also seeks to foreground the possibility of a kind of heroic amalgamation of Devi as pure transcendence, Devi as Brahman, and Devi as corpse. You know, so it was not just a kind of philosophical interest, but it was also a kind of poetic interest in this central paradox of Tantric Shaktism. And in fact, I was thinking about the metaphysical poets, you know, how they were sort of wedding two absolutely different and oppositional ideas, and how they were sort of amalgamating ideas which seemed absolutely unconnected, disconnected. So this this kind of theological paradox, which I saw embodied in the figure of the Devi as corpse, was what I was primarily interested in. And that was how this project came into being. I mean, that was how it originated, you know.
Okay, so there's obviously a rich amount of information there. Let us break it down a little bit for the sake of our listenership, some of whom might be specialists in Hinduism and quite well-read, and some of whom may be educated public, interested public, who may not have some of the background. So let's maybe take the 3,000-foot view of the work. There's many things you mention and allude to that maybe we can unpack. I'll mention a couple of them, then we can dig into them. The first thing let's do for our audience is talk a little bit about tantric traditions and the use of corpses. You obviously take it for granted because you're well-versed in the material, but this is a highly intriguing, possibly subversive, at very least unconventional method of religiosity. And another thing I'd like you to unpack and even relay is the myth of Sati. It's a very, very common, powerful mythological entity that really feeds into your thesis very well. You have a chapter on it, as a matter of fact. So talk about the religiosity of corpses, and then perhaps tell us, relay for us the myth of Sati, if you may.
So I think it would be better for me to sort of begin with the myth of Sati, because then it would be
perfect.
Yes. Yeah, to discuss the concept of Devi as corpse in the larger context of the corpse-related spirituality.
Even better.
Yeah. So now the interesting point is that when we look at the myth of Sati, the central myth is like this, that Sati was an incarnation of the great goddess on earth, and particularly the Shakta tantric traditions focus on this this idea of Sati being not just a mortal woman, but rather the human incarnation of the goddess, human avatar of the great goddess. And then she was desirous of sort of getting Shiva as her husband, and Daksha, her father, in spite of some kind of reservation on his part, consented to sort of marry her off to Shiva. And Brahma intervened, and Daksha married Sati off to Shiva. But after that, Daksha developed a deep-seated sort of antipathy towards Shiva, and he began to denounce Shiva in the public ceremonies of worship, of yajnas, and so on and so forth. At one point of time, Daksha arranged a great yajna, a great fire sacrifice, and everyone in the earth, including the different kinds of beings, like the siddhas, gandharvas, the gods and goddesses, everyone was invited except Shiva and Sati. On hearing this, Sati was deeply shocked, and she wanted to go to that fire sacrifice, that great ceremony arranged by her father. She asked Shiva to permit her to go there, but Shiva was unwilling to permit her to go to that great sacrifice. Now, here I have to mention that as far as this central myth of Shiva and Sati is concerned, which is common to many Puranic texts and many epical texts as well. So as far as this myth is concerned, it's a very, very common and widely sort of circulated myth in the Indian subcontinent. But there are textual variations and sort of narrative variations as far as the different texts are concerned. For instance, in the Shiva Purana, you don't have the story, the narrative that Sati is showing Shiva her terrible form. So when Shiva doesn't permit her to go to Daksha's fire sacrifice. But in the Shakta Puranas, that is to say the Puranas, the Puranic texts, which focus on Shakti as the central deity, or Devi as the central deity, in those texts, we have the the appearance of the terrible forms, the Dasha Mahavidya forms, the great knowledge forms, or the great Mahavidya forms of Devi, when she becomes enraged on seeing her husband reluctant to let her go to Daksha's fire sacrifice. After seeing these terrible forms of Sati, which are really a shock to Shiva, because he is not acquainted with these terrible forms. So he knows only this sweet wife, Sati. So after seeing these terrible forms, so he becomes frightened and he allows Sati to go to Daksha's fire sacrifice. After going to the fire sacrifice of Daksha, she finds herself in a very problematic situation, because on seeing her, Daksha begins to denounce Shiva publicly. And all the devas, all the gods and goddesses are assembled there. But in that assembly, that great assembly, Daksha begins to openly denigrate Shiva. So Sati becomes enraged and Sati curses Daksha. This is a particular textual variation which we find in the Shakta Puranas. So here we find Sati cursing Daksha, and then particularly in the Mahabhagavata Upapurana, there is this story that Sati creates a Chaya Sati, or a shadow form out of her own body, and then she disappears, asking this shadow of hers to enter the fire that has been kindled for the sacrifice. So that Chaya Sati, or the shadows of Sati, enters the Yajna Kunda, and then her body is her body turns into a corpse. It's a charred corpse. So on hearing about the tragic event of Sati's death, again, I will put death within quotes, at the great assembly of Daksha's fire sacrifice, on hearing about this, Shiva, along with his attendants, who are at this point of time very ferocious, because they are angry that Sati is dead. So Shiva comes to Daksha's place and he destroys the entire fire sacrifice and also beheads Daksha. Now, there are slight textual variations as far as the different different Puranas are concerned. For instance, in certain Puranas, Sati doesn't create the Chaya Sati, but rather she leaves her body through a yogic kriya, etc., etc. So I have detailed all those differences, all those variations in my book. And but the interesting point that after this particular event of the destruction of Daksha's Yajna, we have another very important narrative unit in the Shiva Sati myth, particularly in the texts which we find prevalent in the eastern parts of India. That is the creation of the Satipithas. So the idea is that after seeing his wife lying dead in the palace of Daksha, Shiva becomes hugely aggrieved, and he takes Sati's corpse on his head, or in some Puranas it's said that he takes Sati's corpse on his shoulders, and then he begins to roam the entire world, and he also begins to dance. So it's a kind of destructive dance, and Vishnu is afraid of the terrible consequences of this dance, because he thinks that the entire universe may be jeopardized, the stability of the entire universe may be jeopardized if Shiva continues with this dance of his. So he cuts off the body of Sati into different pieces, and all these different pieces fall on 51 places on the earth. And in these 51 places, the great Satipithas are, the great Satipithas are constituted. The interesting thing is that when look at this story critically, we find that here is this particular shift from the mainstream narratives of Shiva Sati myth to the Shakta Tantric reconfigurations of the same. Particularly in that, we have in this context, in the Shakta Tantric context, we have a very significant amount of emphasis being placed on this apparently apocryphal portion of the story, that is to say, the creation of the Satipithas. Now, the creation of the Satipithas is not there as far as the sort of, the mainstream configurations of the myth are concerned. It's a particularly Eastern Indian addition to this myth. But interestingly, this particular portion of this myth about the creation of the Satipithas becomes central to the mode of Shakta Tantric spirituality, which we find in Eastern India. Because in Eastern India, in most cases, we'll find that the Tantric sadhakas are visiting these places, these Shaktipithas, though I will not say that the Shaktipithas are confined only to the geocultural location of Eastern India. For instance, in Northern India, in Southern India too, you have certain Shaktipithas. And there is a long-standing ambiguity. There is a perennial sort of trouble as far as the exact location the exact locations of these Shaktipithas are concerned. But the point is that when we look at that particular tantric mode of spirituality, which focuses on the visit of the sadhaka, the spiritual aspirant within the Shakta Tantric framework, his visit to these places, because these places are supposed to be specially filled with the energy of the Devi, you know, so they are special places, as it were. They are not like any other temple of the goddess.
So regarding this myth of Sati, and could you relay for our audience your use of it in your book? In terms of the ultimate argument you're making?
Yeah. Now, I basically focused on this myth with reference to a larger spectrum of corpse-oriented spirituality in Tantric Shaktism. Now, in the Tantric traditions, the corpse is often seen as a central metaphor for spiritual sadhana. For instance, if you think about the Agharis of Banaras. Jonathan Parry has worked on them. And in the Agharis or in some other sort of left-hand or the Bamachari traditions of Tantra, you have this arcane focus on the corpse. Even there is this ritual practice of necrophagy in Banaras as far as the Agharis are concerned. But again, the interesting point is that whereas in the Shiva-centric Tantric sadhanas, the corpse would be seen in a particular way, like, you know, an inert corpse. So that is linked to the idea of the Nirguna Brahman or the unqualified Brahman. In the Shakta Tantric traditions, this configuration of the corpse is very different. I mean, the configuration of the corpse would involve the idea of an active corpse. That is to say, the limbs of Devi's corpse, which are there in all these pithas, they are, as it were, always throbbing with life energy. They are not just dead. And they are not nirguna or unqualified or inert either. Secondly, whereas Shiva as corpse, because that is also a very important idea as far as Shaktism is concerned. For instance, we all know about the image of Kali, where you have Shiva lying as a corpse under her feet. And she is the representation of a very dynamic energy, a very dynamic female energy. So that is there, but as far as Devi herself is configured as a corpse, the entire connotation of the corpse gets altered. So here the corpse, as it were, becomes an active corpse. Even in its corpse-like state, it is not wholly inert. It is not, as it were, you know, it is not wholly dead. Now, so there is something paradoxical about Devi as corpse. Whereas when we think about Shiva as corpse or Shiva configured as a corpse, we don't find a similar kind of paradox. There, Shiva is likened to a corpse in terms of the general connotation of a corpse. But as far as Devi as corpse is concerned, we find Devi's corpse peculiarly active, because the moment you touch the limb of Devi's corpse in any of these Shaktipithas, you are supposed to be energized, you know. So it's not just about a spiritual energy, it's even about the material energy or the occult energy that is required for Bhoga, not just for moksha, but also for Bhoga. But the material and earthly enjoyments. So I think that is very interesting. I mean, as far as this difference between Shiva as corpse and Devi as corpse is concerned, because in the existing body of literature on this issue, I have found mainly a focus on Shiva as corpse, not exactly on Devi as corpse. You know? So that's why I took up this particular issue.
Well, it's a fascinating paradox, this asymmetry of Shiva being truly inactive as a corpse versus Devi somehow, the goddess somehow nevertheless being active, even in her aspect as a dismembered corpse. What would you say the main takeaway of this work is? What would you like readers to most, what would you like to most impress upon your readers?
You know, I think there are two or three things which might seem quite interesting and original to the readers. One is this this very idea that the Shaktipithas can be brought into a philosophical framework. You know, as far as the Shakta Tantric traditions of Eastern India are concerned, we don't find a very large, solid, or well-organized corpus of philosophical writings or philosophical discourses about this. As we all know, as far as the Kashmir Shaivai traditions of Tantra are concerned, or as far as the Srividya traditions of South India are concerned, we have a very well-organized philosophical tradition. For instance, when we think about the Srividya traditions, we don't just think about rituals, you know. We do think about the very very sophisticated philosophical tradition which is associated with the ritual practices of Srividya. The same is the case with the Kashmir Shaivism. For instance, as far as Kashmir Tantra is concerned, we find a well-organized kind of philosophical tradition. But as far as the Eastern Indian traditions are concerned, we find that there is mostly a focus on the rituals. So basically, the approach of the scholars to these traditions has been a kind of ethnographic approach, you know, not so much a philosophical approach. So I tried to sort of bridge this gap, this apparent gap between ethnography and philosophy as far as the tantric traditions of Eastern India are concerned. Because it seemed to me that here what was being done is, actually people were practicing something, people were exercising something which they believed in. So they were probably setting in motion a kind of philosophy of life which is more practical, which is oriented towards a more practical kind of enlightenment than simply a theoretical kind of enlightenment. For instance, if you think about the Shava Sadhana, and I think one of the very important points of this book is this this connection that I have sought to make between Sati as corpse or Devi as corpse, that central motif in Tantric Shaktism in Eastern India, and the idea of Shava Sadhana or the corpse rituals. Now, there have been works on corpse rituals. For instance, June McDaniel has worked on corpse rituals in Bengal. She has interviewed a lot of practitioners in Calcutta and also in the other parts of West Bengal. But the point is that the connection that we can make between this very new Puranic reconfiguration of the Shiva Sati myth in terms of a focus, a central focus on the topos of Devi as corpse, the connection that we can make between this trope of Devi as corpse and the Shava-centric, the corpse-centric spirituality, And another interesting thing is that when we look at the folk narratives about Shavasadhana, or the narratives which come from the practitioners themselves, we basically find that they are experiencing something which is momentous. For instance, at the moment of the success of this sadhana, probably the goddess would appear to them through the shava, through the corpse, and the corpse would suddenly begin to speak. There is one narrative where it is said that the corpse which was used in this shava, in the shava sadhana, was re-energized with the energy of light by God, by the goddess, and that corpse came back to life. You know, so it was enlivened through Devi's grace. Now, the interesting point is that at the material level, this kind of enlightenment regarding the connection, the connection between death and life, death being not a closure to life, but rather a new entry to another form of life. Now, this kind of idea is what I have tried to underline in my work. And I have also associated this idea of the fragmentation of Devi's corpse with a kind of deconstructivist approach to the idea of the human self. I have argued that through the dismemberment of the corpse of Sati, and also through Shiva's decision to live along with Devi in all these pithas, in his linga forms or in his Vaidava forms, through this process, the self is being presented as essentially multiple and not singular. You know, so I have also done a little bit of analysis of the rhetoric of the Pitha Nirnaya, the very famous text regarding the Satipithas, where I have tried to decode the rhetoric used by Devi, where she talks about her body as a singular body at one point of time, and then she goes on to talk about her body in terms of the fragmented limbs. And then she also talks about her multiplicitous existence in all these pithas. So that is another sort of theoretical intervention which I have sought to make. And finally, I have also focused on another issue, that is the connection between the fragmented corpse of Sati and the Vishwarupa of Devi. You know, I think this kind of connection has not been made earlier. What I have argued here is that in Devi's cosmic form, we have the dissolution of the borders of the body. Because in a way, following Mary Douglas, we can see the body as being constituted essentially by its borders, not by any internal essence, but by its borders. So the body itself is a metaphor for a bordered mode of being. Now, when the border is dissolved, particularly in the context of the fragmentation of the corpse of Sati, we find the journey of the body towards a kind of borderless body, you know? Again, another kind of paradox. And the same thing is what we find in the idea of Devi's Vishwarupa, where again, it's a borderless body. Because this entire cosmos is being presented as Devi's body, but it's not being presented as a totality in the conventional sense of the term, but rather it's being presented as a kind of endless plurality, endless plenitude of being. And I have also associated this idea with Adriana Cavrero's approach to the issue of death. She says that as far as death is concerned, we have an individuated kind of idea of death. So the moment a person dies, we believe that that person's life has become negated. But if we shift our gaze from this individuated discourse of, or rather this individualistic discourse of death, to a more ecologically holistic approach to the issue of death, then we can probably say that through this process of death, one life form gets transformed into another life form, and thereby one life form is getting dissolved in the perennial flow of life itself. Now, I found this idea very interesting, and I found this idea absolutely applicable to my own project of looking at this trope of Devia's corpse. And that's why I wedded sort of this Cavararian theory to the tantric epistemology of the body. And I tried to look at the body, particularly with reference to the dismemberment motive, you know, I mean, the dismemberment of Devi's corpse. With reference to that, I tried to focus on this issue of dissolving the body. Of the body, which is also very important as far as the tantras are concerned.
So the cosmic form of the Devi, the supreme Devi, is not just the one and many. She's not just the one and the many. She's also the fragment and the whole at the same time, it seems.
Exactly.
There's this wonderful paradox encapsulated. You may or may not know, but my work is on the Devi Mahatmya. So okay. the goddess myths. There are four hymns in the text. The second one is a very beautiful hymn, the Shakradi Stuti. Yeah. And one of the pairs of couplets in this elegant hymn basically says, yeah. You know, the Devi, they say to the Devi, they're addressing her. They basically say, your face is so beautiful. It's resplendent like the moon. How could the Asuras dare strike it? And the next verse say, but also how could they survive beholding the enraged face of death? And you have the sense that to be totality, she's life as well as death, but not a death that negates life, but a death that is somehow part of life.
Exactly, part of life. And you know, another thing is very interesting, and this is what I have also argued in this book. It's very good that you have brought in this issue of the Devi Mahatmya, because in the Devi Mahatmya, we have this continuous reference to the paradoxical nature of Devi. So, and the interesting thing is that when we talk about the enigma of Devi, we basically try to talk about the paradoxes of Devi. Probably, you know, the Devi cult in Hinduism is the most paradoxical form of figuration of the divine, the most paradoxical figuration of the divine. And interestingly, as you have rightly pointed out, I mean, when we think about Devi, we find her embodying both the agency of life and the agency of death, you know. So she can kill, she can bring something into life, she can bring something into life, and she can take that back. In fact, as far as the goddess Kamakshya is concerned, I'm talking about the Kamakshya temple, the very famous Kamakshya temple of Assam in India. As far as the myth of goddess Kamakshya, or rather the folk narratives regarding goddess Kamakshya are concerned, there is the idea that there used to be one particular group of people who would mystically hear the summons of the Devi. The Devi was called Ai in that context. So it was supposed that they would hear this mystic call of the Devi, and then they would go to the temple and they would offer themselves to be sacrificed in front of Devi. You know, so it's a very peculiar kind of situation where you have a kind of voluntary human sacrifice, where the human being is willing to sacrifice in his own life for the sake of the Devi. And interestingly, here the idea is that Devi can give the life, and Devi also has the right to take back that life. And it's basically a very powerful paradox. If you think about the entire issue of bioethics or ecoethics, we are actually trying to grapple with this issue, you know. I mean, who has the right to create life, and who has the right to take back life? I mean, does anybody have really the right to take back life? Now, the point is that when we think about the goddess cult, we find that the goddess is not just the creatrix of life and the destroyer of life, but rather she is also the creatrix and the corpse at once. You know, so she herself is the corpse, as it were. She doesn't kill simply the life forms which she has created, but she can also kill her own embodied living form, you know, which we find also in the image of goddess Chinnamasta, for instance.
Yes, this fearsome goddess who decapitates herself. Yes,
exactly. Chinnamasta.
So there's so many things that come to mind. I visited the Kamakya temple once. This must have been in 2012 in Assam, correct?
It's in Assam. Yeah.
And so in growing up, probably with most folks who had a Hindu background, I didn't have a particularly religious upbringing at all, but my home was Hindu in the way that many modern Catholics practice Catholicism, where they may go to Mass on Easter or Good Friday type thing. Nevertheless, the value system was part of the ethos of the home, and so we had a non-vegetarian home, but one would never eat meat on a religious holiday. One would never eat meat going to temple. So this association with religiosity and vegetarianism, or conversely, this idea of the carnage of eating meat being polluting to a sacrifice, right? So it fosters a sensitivity such that I think most of us have this, where we may quite enjoy chicken, but maybe not after passing by a butcher shop and seeing chickens hung upside down in the window, because then it's a little too close to home. And so I had this very powerful experience where something really shifted in my consciousness, because I did not know until having arrived there. It was after a barrage of language training at the American Institute of Indian Studies in Pune. Then I thought to visit some sites before coming back to Toronto. Okay. And I did not realize, but they actually sacrificed animals at this temple. And I saw a platter upon which there was the head of a buffalo, in fact.
Yeah.
And usually such a sight would be very, very jarring for me, because I'm very sensitive to roadkill or carnage. But in that moment, it was so beautifully, like aesthetically pleasing. It was so beautifully put together on this platter. It was stunning. It was this moment of seeing something sublimely beautiful and also a decapitated head at the same time. And it was a moment where it was like the commingling of opposites, right? And so I wouldn't have thought impossible to behold the head of an animal and have such an aesthetic experience unless I'd visited this temple and happened to see them bring out the offering right before darshan. So it's quite something. It is quite something, this paradox of life and death. That's another thought that comes to mind is I often go back to this notion of transformation, that life and death being two poles in this ongoing transformative power of nature that Devi is associated with, that nature eats itself to propel itself. And yet when you talk about Shiva as a corpse, it's very, very different. I mean, I think your point is valid. We've taken a fair bit of your time for today. What is the next project? What's the next step? What are you working on now?
You know, I am now working on the history of the authoritative female speeches in the goddess traditions of India. Particularly, I am trying to focus on the very long and very rich tradition of speeches coming from women goddesses, female gurus, or even, you know, the wise wives of not so spiritually enlightened husbands. Now, this entire corpus of writing, which is there in the Hindu traditions, this entire corpus is something which we need to look back at, because at the present moment, we are hearing a lot of debates regarding the very very significance of the position of the speaking woman in a patriarchal society. For instance, if you think about this entire discourse about women's planning and all that. Now, what is basically being sought to be foregrounded is that somehow the female speech doesn't have that amount of that kind of access to the public sphere which the male speech has. Now, in this context, I'm trying to revisit the Indian traditions of Goddess spirituality, where I have this very important, very significant corpus of writings. And these writings involve all kinds of writing, like philosophical discourses, narratives, stories, narratives, encapsulating philosophical discourses. For instance, there are certain narratives of wise women, I mean, spiritually enlightened women who are spiritually enlightening their husbands. So that kind of narrative is there in the very famous Tripura Rahasya. So I'm also dealing with that. And I'm also trying to find out the possible connections between the co-configuration of Vidya or knowledge and the feminine, and the probable connections between this composite form of Vidya and the feminine, or Vidya as some feminine entity, and women speakers who are, who are mortal women, who are not goddesses, but who are mortal women, and still they might have some kind of connection with the goddess traditions of India. So I'm trying to explore that. That is my present project. And actually, it's a recuperative project whereby I'm trying to link the past sort of histories, the past narratives, with the present narratives. For instance, what kind of authority do we find in the speeches of the female gurus of the 20th century? In many cases, these female gurus, for instance, if you think about Anandamayi or even Ma Sarada, the wife of Ramakrishna Paramahansa, you find that in these cases, their speeches have a peculiar kind of authority, which is connected not just to their status as female gurus, but also to their status as the avatars of the goddess, because they were seen by their devotees as the avatars of the goddess. So what kind of connection can you build between these apparently sort of disconnected cultural phenomena? That's my present project.
That sounds fascinating. I'll ask you one quick question about your project, because it's something that comes up a fair bit in my thinking. And that is, when you have a figure like Anandamayi Ma of the last century, or even Amritanandamayi, Amma of the century, comparable in various ways, and they're venerated because of their spiritual authority and their attainment. Now, here's a question, and maybe it's too early to answer from your research, but is your sense that we can begin to equate women as goddesses in the Hindu tradition, or a goddess is something very, very different than humans, much less human women? What do you think?
Now, see, I'm very happy, Raj, that you have brought in this question, because this is one of the most vexed sort of areas in the discussions of goddess spirituality, as far as the Indian goddess traditions are concerned. For instance, recently, Mandakranta Bose has also sort of published this book on Devi. She has edited a lot of very important essays which deal with this question: that what was the position of women vis-a-vis this hallowed figure of the goddess? So was there really a direct connection between the empowered figure of the goddess and the women, the mortal women, or was there a kind of paradox? Toxical relationship between the powerful goddess and the disempowered woman. Now, my approach to this issue is something like that, like this. But when we think about the possibility of a direct connection between the disempowered, woman, the mortal woman, and the goddess, the divine female, we probably don't find a direct connection, you know. So it's not that women's empowerment in the Indian context directly proceeds from the figuration of the powerful goddess. That is not the case. But at the same time, I would not like to endorse the idea that there has not been any connection between the goddess traditions of India and women's empowerment in limited context. So when we think about women's empowerment, we also need to think about the context-specific definition of empowerment, right? For instance, in the context of, say, Anandamayi Ma, we have one kind of empowerment, In the context of probably the secular idea of women's empowerment, we have another idea of empowerment. So when we are talking about women's empowerment in the context of goddess spirituality in India, we need to pluralize the very definition of power and empowerment as far as the gender equations in any patriarchal society are concerned. Secondly, what I find quite interesting in this context is that we first need to sort of excavate a lot of histories of women who were empowered in their own ways. And this is what I'm trying to do. For instance, when we think about the figures of apparently empowered women or apparently wise, spiritually enlightened women in the Puranic and Tantric texts, we need to understand that probably there was a kind of, a larger social and cultural spectrum within which these texts were implicated. So that spectrum is no more available to us. For instance, we don't know whether there was really a socio-cultural equivalent of Amada Lhasa or Churala. We don't know. But the point is that to say that these figures are just mythical figures is something which is problematic for me, because this is my conviction that I do believe very strongly that as far as the history of women's sort of voices is concerned, this history is always interrupted. And more often than not, this history is characterized by gaps, by silences, by what is left in the dark, by what is not enunciated. So when we think about the history of women, we need to think about not a history of enunciation, but rather a history of silences. But we also need to build up a new kind of hermeneutic framework to deal with those apparent silences. For instance, it is quite possible that in terms of the societal reality, there is an apparent silence, but as far as the texts are concerned, there are certain enunciations. Now, we need to sort of dialectically negotiate with the silences and these speeches which you find in the texts. And my PhD work, my own doctoral work, was on this question of Diotima, who figures in Plato's Symposium. And Socrates claims that he learned his own erotic philosophy from Diotima. But there is a very long tradition of patriarchal scholarship which says that Diotima was not real. She was just a fiction of Socrates. But there is a very significant feminist corpus of writing which argues very powerfully and very convincingly that Diotima was not unreal, but rather it is the patriarchal tradition which has come to derealize her, as Miglena Nikolchina puts it. I think the same kind of idea needs to be kept in mind when we think about the relationship between these goddess figures and the real women in the Indian traditions. For instance, I personally know about a lot of stories, and not just stories, but sort of real kind of narratives, real life women who have done something which is not exactly the same as that which is there in codified orthodox Hindu religious systems. For instance, if you think about, I think you might be interested in this because you have worked on the Devi Mahatmya. Your own book is on the Devi Mahatmya. So as far as the Devi Mahatmya is concerned, in Bengal, there was a very long tradition of a kind of Brahminical appropriation of the text and a very exclusionary kind of construction of the ritual of Chandipatha or the recitation of the Chandi, or the Devi Mahatmya, where it was argued that women should not touch the Devi Mahatmya, that book, But interestingly, even though in the Orthodox codified religious system you have this kind of idea, there are a lot of real women. Some of them are personally known to me. There are sort of written documents about some others. And these women have flouted these norms. They have ritualistically recited the Chandi for a long period of time. And the Chandi or the Devi Mahatmya has been a source of spiritual inspiration to them. So I personally believe that we need to look at these micro-narratives. Whenever we are confronted with a moment of silence in the history of women in Hinduism, we need to look at the multiple layers of that silence, because I believe that as far as the silences are concerned within the domain of women's function in Hindu religiosity, I think all the silences are multi-layered. They are immensely textured. So we need to look through these multiple layers of those silences. You know? So that's my take on this particular issue, and that's the hermeneutic model which I'm trying to apply. In my current project as well.
Surely a nuanced take such as yours is required for so complex and controversial an issue. Because while on the one hand, we certainly cannot say that the goddess is equatable to a Hindu woman or any woman, on the other hand, certainly these texts that feature the feminine divine have without a doubt pushed the envelope of inclusion of women in ritual practice in the Hindu world. Just two short anecdotes. I don't do ethnographic work. I'm not sure why that is, because I quite enjoy attending and studying as an armchair ethnographer in these situations. But way back in my undergrad days, school was something I had to force myself to do when I wasn't socializing. So the idea that I can get credit for socializing, I didn't realize this was such a thing. But two very brief examples in my experience that you raised regarding the chanting of the Chandi. One is in the same year I was last in India, 2012, during my Sanskrit program, I was staying in an apartment complex owned by it was in Maharashtra, so it was a Hindu Marathi family that I was staying across the hall from them in their complex. They rented the unit was there for students coming. Okay. And so this happened to be fall. I was there for the entire fall. And during fall, of course, there's the big Durga Puja where the Chandipath is chanted. And the auntie who was the mother of the home, the family patroned folks to come in and chant the Chandipath. These folks that came in to chant it were two women, two relatively middle-aged women who were initiated by somebody with the authority to initiate it. Okay. And the auntie said, if you want, Raj can chant along with you. He knows the Chandipath. And it was such a beautiful moment of reversal, because they were saying, well, we don't know if he can. We don't know if he's been initiated in the text. Otherwise, we're not allowed to chant with somebody who hasn't been initiated. I found it absolutely brilliant. The other example, an entire world away. In the Richmond Hill Hindu Temple, just about an hour north of Toronto, it's the Tamil speaking community, primarily South Indian style Hinduism. So a lot there, for example, the food, the language, the dress, some the festivals are very, very foreign to me. I'm as lost as just about anybody coming in from Toronto. And yet, of course, you know, elements of the puja and the Sanskrit are very familiar. And so every year they have a huge fire ceremony, yajna for the Devi for Durga Puja, and people come along. You know, the it's only the priests obviously that handle the murtis or make the official oblations, but people come along. Anyone's invited to come along and bring their Chandipath and chant. And the majority of folks that come out are women, and they chant along for the ritual. It really is fascinating. It struck me at the time, but I didn't have the background to know.
I think Raj, I am also working on certain forms of Hindu practices as well as the pedagogies of Hindu studies in Canada. I almost every year I am invited by Jadavpur University because they have this Canadian Studies Center. That's a nodal center as far as Eastern India is concerned. They are connected with the Indo-Canadian Shastri Institute. I think the Shastri Institute for Indo-Canadian Studies. So I go there, and what I find very interesting about the Hindu cultures in Canada is that there is a very progressive reconfiguration of the Hindu traditions in Canada. For instance, there you have the temples where you have multiple deities. So here you have not just one deity, but the different deities are there, and people can go there. People from different sort of faith groups, different sort of faith communities, like, a Shaiva can go to the same temple, the Shakta can go to the same temple, etc. And as you rightly point out, this freedom that, anyone can bring the scripture with him or her and can recite it. So that kind of flexibility and that kind of freedom is what probably characterizes the Hindu practices in Canada. And I'm particularly interested in the practices of Hinduism, how Hinduism is practiced in a very new way in Canada today, and also about the Hindu studies paradigms, because I did a course from the Oxford Center of Hindu Studies. I think I my tutor was Nick Sutton at that point of time. What I find interesting is that, when you think about the Hindu studies paradigms and the Hindu studies programs, there are slight differences between the Canadian frameworks of Hindu studies, the American frameworks, and the British frameworks. And I'm fascinated with these differences, with these sort of multiple sort of pedagogical frameworks that you can build up for Hindu studies in India. Interestingly, there is actually no sort of a center for Hindu studies as such. Even in Banaras Hindu University, you don't have a center for Hindu studies, So there you have a kind of interdisciplinary center for Indic studies. You have a center for Sanskritic knowledge systems. But the kind of Hindu studies that suppose you are doing, I am doing, or that is being done, in today's academia, that is not systematically done here. But I think in India too, we can build up some cultural studies frameworks, or some kind of autoethnographic frameworks for doing this. For instance, when I was visiting these different Shaktipithas, I was also trying to wed ethnography to textual studies, because that was absolutely required. Because as I've already told you, sometimes what the text says and what the practitioner does in reality are poles apart. So the tantric text would tell you something, but the tantric practitioner would tell you something else. Because that practitioner has probably gone through an experience which is not encoded in the tantric text. So this text and sort of living culture interface is very important as far as my own methodology is concerned. And I think that's also the case with you, I guess.
Well, there's no doubt in my mind that especially in Indian religions, where there's so much emphasis on a parampara sampradaya, oral transmission, that the text, a great example, is the Yoga Sutras. They're skeletal. They're absolutely skeletal. Anybody who sits down and tries to understand them outside of a living tradition, I'm not sure what they're trying to understand, because the text was not ever meant to be read as we would read a text off of a shelf in the West. It was meant to be exposited by someone. This is probably much more the case in tantric practices, where there are where there is a fair bit of secrecy and esotericism and occult practice, and so.
And, also the involvement of the body, which is very interesting, which is also the case with the Yoga Sutras. For instance, let me put it in this way. With every living body practicing the yoga in a way, everyone is breathing a new kind of life into the Yoga Sutra, because everyone's breath is operating in a unique way, in a different way. So you can't actually homogenize the ways the breath operates in a human body. Probably the mode of operation of the breath in the human body is very different from one living human body to another. And in Tantra too, the same thing is happening. So for instance, when we think about this body-oriented rituals or the rituals which require some kind of physical involvement, the interesting thing is that every human body is probably rewriting the text in a way, right? I mean, it is putting a new kind of flesh onto that text, that skeletal framework of the text.
Well, the favorite analogy that I have that comes to mind, there's two analogies that come to mind a lot when I teach and think about this, and remind myself about this, but my favorite analogy is I was a classically trained musician throughout my teenage years until about when I went to university. I switched to English as a major focus, but there's so much to be taught and learned about music theory and a music score. That's necessary. Having said that, the music theorist, may or may not be tone deaf. They may or may not have ever experienced the musical phrase. There are different experiences such that you can play a guitar. You don't need lungs to play a guitar. But there are other instruments where the breath is very much intertwined with the production of sound. And so musicality is my favorite example in terms of like an experience. And also you have, when you have a perfectly canon work, say say a Mozart concerto, you're going to have every single, say it's a violin concerto, the violin virtuoso is going to have his individual stamp on that concerto. The conductor conducting the audience is going to give his individual stamp on that concerto, although the arrangement and the scoring is precisely as we see in the written text. And so that's one of my favorite examples to draw on.
It's a very apt example. Yeah, it's a very appropriate example, actually, because, you know, this kind of performative aspect of religion is very important as far as Hinduism is concerned. I mean, it's more oriented towards the practice. You know, that's why we always talk about the sadhakas, the practitioners, not just about the ritualists, you know, who are performing the rituals, but also, we are more sort of interested in those who are performing the sadhana, who is doing this kind of internalized kind of spiritual performance. So that's very important. And it's also important to map the history of this performative dimension of Hinduism as far as Hindu studies is concerned. And that's what I try to do. I try to look at the interface. Sometimes this kind of interface is quite evident. Sometimes it's not so overt. But we need to excavate and decode these points of interface between the performative aspect and the textual aspect of a particular Hindu cultural or religious tradition. That's what I feel.
Absolutely. There's one other point that I'd like to touch on before I close, because certainly it's fairly late where you are. You were quite a few hours ahead of me. You're located in India right now. Not only is there a difference between the embodied or performative aspect and the textual traditions, but within what we see on paper, it's very different, as you alluded to earlier in our interview. Sutra or treatise is very different from narrative text. It's much more difficult to access, but also much more powerfully encoded when the philosophy is in the narrative. And this is maybe one thing you could touch on. I mean, you probably would agree that the narrative is crafted so as to embody deep, profound philosophy, but in a very unassuming way. This has been my sort of what I found to be true, and maybe you could make a remark about narrative in your work and the extent to which you have, for example, philosophical exposition in Kashmiri Shaivism or Sri Vidya, but in the traditions you're looking at, you're literally decoding stories. Maybe you could make a comment about that before we close.
Exactly. Actually, you know, when I look at the traditions of Tantra practiced in the eastern parts of India, I find that the stories are very important. Now, we can divide these narratives into multiple categories. For instance, on the one hand, you have the Sanskritic texts which have which include these stories, the Puranic texts, or even the Tantric texts. For instance, when we think about the Yogini Tantra, that includes certain narratives. But on the other hand, we also have the folk narratives. For instance, a particular Puranic story may get transformed into very different kinds of folk narratives. And that's why in this text, and probably you have noticed this, I have also dealt with the vernacular narratives, like, you know, the Bengali narrative. Then I have also dealt with the kind of Sthala Puranas, the local narratives, the local mythologies, which are there in these different sort of eco-theological centers of Shaktism. For instance, when we think about a particular temple, for instance, if you think about Kamakhya, or if you think about any other Shaktipit in West Bengal, you find that each of them has a folk narrative associated with them. Now, that folk narrative may or may not be directly connected to the Sanskritic narrative tradition. So that means that when we look at these frames of goddess spirituality within the tantric traditions, we need to take into account both the folk and vernacular traditions and the Sanskritic traditions. Now, they have different narrative traditions. For instance, in one particular context, while talking about the goddess Kamakhya in this book, I have tried to look at the possible connections between the folk narratives regarding Kamakhya and the Sanskritic tradition. Now, you know, I am particularly not interested in a kind of genealogical or a kind of historiographical study where I will just focus on the possible origination of the Sanskritic text in the folk traditions or vice versa. I'm not interested in that because it's very difficult to make any decisive comment about the possible genealogies. You know, I mean, whether the folk tradition inflected the Sanskritic tradition or vice versa. I really don't know whether we can at all reach any decisive point regarding that. But what I find interesting is that between the Sanskritic tradition and the folk, and the folk narrative traditions, there is some kind of commonality, some kind of connection. And as far as the practiced and performed, religion is concerned, we can find the traces of both the folk traditions and the Sanskrit and the Sanskritic traditions there. And that kind of amalgamation is what I am hugely interested in. So this is one thing. Then secondly, as you are absolutely right, while dealing with such traditions, we need to pay great attention to the narratives. The framings of these narratives, you have worked on the frames of the narrative. So the framing of the narrative is also very important. And it would be absolutely wrong to believe that the frame functions in the Indic narrative traditions simply as an introduction or as an entry point to the main story. They are more than that. And in fact, the way you are worked on the frame narratives, I have also worked on the frame narratives, particularly in my present work. I am trying to look at the frame stories and the narratives which are located within that larger narrative framework. So the macro narrative structure and the micro narratives, which are, as it were, engrafted into that larger narrative structure. So this is what I'm trying to look at. And another interesting thing is that when we try to look at the narratives, we find that they are probably presenting something which you can call philosophy in action. So it's not just a theoretical philosophy. It's not just a doctrine, but it's more than that. It's how you are supposed to live. So it's something which you can also relate to the idea of jnana. You know, jnana in the sense of Mahayana, Hinayana, etc., where jnana means the way of life. So basically here, you find a way of life, a way of living, a way of dying also in the case of the Satipithas. For instance, how to negotiate with this concept of death as absolute closure and the concept of death as an entry point to a new form of life, a new modality of living. So I think that when we look at the narratives, we need to be very cautious. Number one, we can never make a generalized statement like, you know, we can never make a statement like the goddess is essentially empowering for the Hindu women, nor can we make a sweeping generalization regarding the absolute disconnect between the powerful goddess and the disempowered women in Hinduism. I personally believe that no generalized statement would do. That kind of philosophical discourse which we can sort of build from the perspective of these narratives would be quite context-specific, quite context-sensitive. It would not be a kind of generalized philosophical or theoretical framework. And secondly, it would be something which would be grounded in the multiple narrative dynamics, in the various kinds of narrative dynamics which constitute the magic of a text. For instance, a text may tell you something, but it can also undercut that very statement made by itself. So I think all these different nuances of a text, particularly a narrative text in the context of the Puranas or even the folk narratives, I think that kind of nuanced reading, that kind of attentive, close reading is very important. And then it's also necessary to look at how this narrative is getting, as it were, enacted or lived by the people who are practicing that particular religious system, and to look at the ways in which these narratives are being worked on or how they are being reworked by the practitioners of that religion. So my focus is basically on the narrative as it is, but also on the reception of that narrative and the reworking of that narrative by the people who practice that particular religion.
Definitely fascinating work. Today we have been speaking with Anway Mukhopadhyay of the University of Burdwan in West Bengal. We've been speaking with him on his new Routledge publication, The Goddess in Hindu Tantric Traditions, Devious Corpse. It's been a pleasure having you for this interview.
Thank you so much, Raj. It was a pleasure to talk to you regarding so many issues, and it's really a very enriching experience for me as well to know about all these things.
Wonderful. And so for all of you out there listening, until next time, keep reading. Take care.